Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Oh, 51551. My next guest has many titles: radio broadcaster, DJ, podcast host, and of course, best-selling author. And you can call her Annie Mac. You can call her Annie, or you can call her Annie McManus. Isn't that it? That is. What do your folks call you?
They call me Annie.
Annie, right.
They call me Annie, okay. Yeah. It would be weird otherwise, I think.
No, but they could have a pet name for you.
Yeah. Oh, they call me Kneezer.
There you go. You
My
see?
Siblings call me Kneezer. I don't know why.
Why?
Annie, knee. They call me knee or Kneezer.
Right. Yes. Nothing to do with your actual knees.
No, thank you.
No, okay. Right. Great to see you. This is the first time in the radio building,
yes,
in RTE.
I love it. I mean, as a radio geek, I really enjoy visiting other radio studios and, yeah, just seeing what they look like and how they work. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, this would contrast, I'd say, to the studios of BBC Radio 1, because they're all flashing lights and hip and people standing up and all,
yeah,
sorts of things.
Yeah, so they have hydraulic desks, so you can move the desk up and down according to whether you want to stand or sit. And they have different lighting programs, you know, according to mood or color. They're pretty fancy.
My,
yeah,
word, right?
You need to feed back to the bosses, right?
Yeah. So what were your choices then? You were an evening DJ, right, with, yeah, predominantly dance music.
Yes.
So were you standing when you did it or sitting down?
I always stood.
Right.
Yeah, so I actually had a show on Sunday nights for a while that was much more chill, and I sat for that. It felt right. But for high energy music, I felt like it was, I had more energy in me when I stood. You,
yes,
could hear it in my voice, I think.
Uh-huh.
I learned it all from this other DJ called Zane Lowe, who I used to work for. I used to assist him as a producer. So it wasn't until he came into Radio 1 that they had to get the hydraulic desks in, because he was the first guy to ever stand up.
So everything moves. The whole
equipment
moves up.
The whole desk. Right. Everything on it moves up and down.
So it's not like those adjustable ones in IKEA. This is the
whole thing.
There's a lot of technology involved.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Okay, the mess we're in.
Yes.
Is that sort of a nod to PJ Harvey and Tom York?
Yes,
it is. Okay.
Exactly. It's a kind of conflation, I suppose. It's not the exact song title, but I liked it because it's of the era.
And this is your second book.
Yeah.
A heady mix of thrills and heartbreak. I so enjoyed it, says Graham Norton.
There's a lot of people who commented and did that, you know, the quotes that you see on the book covers.
Yes.
A lot of them are people who are Irish who now live in England.
And yes,
I kind of subconsciously targeted them, I think, because I thought hopefully if anyone's going to get this book, I would hope it would be people who have moved away from Ireland and live in London.
And it draws an awful lot on your own experience, although it's not a memoir.
It's definitely not a memoir.
It's fictional.
Yeah.
But Orla is the main character, but
yeah,
a lot of Orla is you.
There's like things that basically it's based on roughly a very formative time in my life when I moved from London over to England.
No, from Dublin over to England.
Sorry, thank,
yes,
you, Ray. From Dublin over to London. Thank you. And so I don't remember a lot of that. So I had to reconnect with a lot of people from that time and kind of remember it. And it's kind of inspired by that time.
Yes.
But the joy of fiction is, you know, everyone's completely different. You dramatize it, you make it more mad, more, you embellish it, you exaggerate it.
So one of the themes then is being Irish in London.
Yes, totally.
And Orla works in an Irish bar, Fahy's Bar.
Yes.
And we meet Mayo David and Jerry.
Yes.
And these are guys who have been there for years, probably worked on the building sites.
Right.
And their only social interaction is the pub.
Yeah, it's kind of more than a pub for them. It's,
yeah,
more like a community centre, you know. And I think I kind of liked the irony of Orla leaving Ireland very much like I did and not looking back. Like, she wanted to go to the big smoke. She was starry eyed. She wanted to, you know, she was obsessed with music and she wanted to go and kind of jump right into the city and everything it brought her. And then she ended up working in this Irish pub. And like I suppose as anyone who leaves their country, you never really think too much about your own sense of national identity until you leave. Like, I didn't consider myself Irish. I just was Irish. And then you leave and you're suddenly reminded that you're Irish everywhere you go. And it's very much like that for her in this bar, because she's surrounded by Irish people. It's in an Irish pub. It's Irish music all day long. But also the kind of, I suppose, the attitude of the older guys who are there is very different than hers, where she isn't that interested in Ireland. She's escaping. She wants to go and see the world. And she's very lucky that she's able to do that by choice. They had to leave Ireland when they were younger. They would have been coming over in the 50s and 60s post-war. Big families at home to send postal order checks home to. And as you said, yeah, like working in the railway lines, you know, laying pipes, all that business.
So they had their rose tinted glasses on, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a kind of romanticized view, I suppose, of Ireland, the Ireland that they left behind. It was fun writing that, and the two very different takes on Ireland and Irishness, you know, according to what generation they were.
You dedicate the book to your two sons, and you say, remember, you're half Irish.
Yeah, it's more like a threat, actually. Don't forget that you're half Irish.
Yeah, sorry, he says, never forget you're half Irish. Yes.
Oh, God.
Pointing the finger. Never
forget. They couldn't if they tried. Because, right. I mean, I dragged them home. No, actually, that's the wrong word. They love coming back here. And it's still home to me. I still call it home. I always will. But we come back on the ferry every summer. We come at Christmas. We come at Easter. We're here all the time.
And your folks are still alive in the family home.
Yes. Same home I was born in.
Yeah. Dundrum.
Dundrum, yeah. First baby to be born in my housing state.
Right.
It's my claim to fame.
Wow. That's a big claim to fame.
Yeah. And they're still there.
Yeah. Because I buy The Guardian every Saturday. Two things that I love about it is the feast, which is the cookery little supplement with it.
And, I like that too.
And this thing they do where they recreate a photograph of somebody. And you were the victim. Sorry. You were the person.
No, it felt like that at the time.
Right. Yeah. So they recreated a picture of you when you were 9 in Marley Park up a tree.
Right.
And you as a 44-year-old woman had to get up the tree for the picture. How was that?
Oh, right. You don't even know the half of it. Like that was one of those existential moments where I'd been DJing all weekend and I show up in this forest outside London and there's a photographer there and this set of clothes that's supposed to be exactly the same as the clothes I was wearing as a 9-year-old. Now, bearing in mind, it was a turquoise two-piece that I was wearing as a 9-year-old. It was a pair of chinos and like this sweater top, but they couldn't source the turquoise chinos. So they had to they put me in turquoise leggings. Like, and I don't know, any woman listening to this, any woman listening to this, like if you're being shot, sat up a tree, being shot from below, wearing turquoise leggings, as a 44-year-old, that's not fun. But anyway, we got through it and it was a nice piece, I suppose.
Yeah, you did well. So which begs the question, you were a tree climber. As
I was.
A 9-year-old girl.
Yeah, I really was.
And a football player.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a tomboy, I suppose.
I suppose, yeah. I was very much like one of the lads.
Can they use that phrase anymore?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I was very much, I guess, as people would say, you know, you shouldn't define a girl in the way of a boy. Like, yes. I was just a girl who liked playing football and liked climbing trees. And I hung out with a lot of boys, though. I was, you know, all my life, I had a lot of friends that were boys and girls, but I've always been comfortable around boys. I have two big brothers, so I was used to, you know, playing with them a lot.
Yeah. And your brother was in the band.
Yes.
And he had a house in London with his bandmates. And that is part of the book.
Yeah, so there's some bits of real experience that I kind of used for the book from living there. There's a scene where a family of mice are found curled up in the bottom of a packet of cornflakes, which is a direct experience that what happened when I lived there. But yeah, so I mean the band are very different, and it's kind of like, what's cool about writing fiction is you never really base anyone on one person. It's just you just take little bits of people and phrases and gestures. And things, and then you kind of build a whole new character out of them, and I really enjoy that aspect of it.
It's like human AI, I suppose. You're scraping your experience and putting it all together. Yeah,
right.
So you've talked about this numerous occasions, but it was a big change from the studio to writing.
And
how many years ago is that now? Is it 4 years ago or more? No, less than 4 years.
I think it was 2021.
Okay, so only
not
that
too
recently.
Long.
Okay,
yeah. I think it was 2021. God, Ray, I should know that and I don't. But it's been long enough to know exactly how it feels, I suppose, to be a writer and to having dedicated time to it now properly as part of my job. And it's really cool. It's so different, though. You know, I suppose the one thing I miss about radio is that element of connection. Like you are, like it is the essence of connection, isn't it? Doing your job, you're sitting there, you're connecting people with people and voices and
people in front of me.
Totally, you're right in the middle of the conversation.
No, very lucky.
At all times.
Yes.
So like I did that mostly with music, but also with conversation. But then when you write, you're just sat at home on your own all day, in your own head. So like what I've really enjoyed about writing is getting out there and meeting people and learning from people and, you know, hearing stories from people and being able to put that in my books. And I'm also just getting better at knowing, you know, to make sure that I have other ways of working with teams.
It strikes me that people of your vintage, will enjoy this book because, as you said, you didn't remember a lot of it for various reasons.
Yeah,
they may not.
Gone.
And this could sort of fill in the bits, because it was a heady time.
It was. So it's 2001, 2002. That's when the book is set. And it was very interesting going back there in my head and just remembering, like, there was smoke everywhere.
Right.
Obviously, you know, this is pre-cigarette bans, smoke everywhere. This is pre-Me Too. So there's a kind of sense of, I suppose, presumed misogyny in the music industry. It's just how it is. There's also, obviously, no social media. There's phones. There's the Nokia 3310. Mm. People used to play Snake. And like, I don't know if you remember when you could download ringtones on your phone.
Yes,
you know?
I do.
So
yes,
that was a new thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was very much people, when they were in the room, only in the room. And they didn't think beyond that. They didn't think how they were going to present their lives to the world. So it was really interesting going back there and just remembering how life was then.
Yeah. And music is a huge part of your life. Each chapter is named after a song.
Yes.
We spotted some of them.
Yeah.
Some of them we didn't.
Yeah.
Like, there's Westlife get a nod, do they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All Westlife were huge, huge then. That was a Westlife heyday.
Right. Were you?
No, I was. I mean, no offense to Westlife,
no.
But they were not my bag.
Yes.
But what I wanted was to, with the chapter titles, is to really try and use them as a tool to bring people back to those times. And it's very hard to write from a certain year and without kind of constantly reminding people, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of, I thought that was a fun way of doing that, kind of bringing them back. But also the chapter titles that are based in the Irish pub, Fahey's,
yes.
All the music is old. It's all like Planxty and the Dubliners,
right,
and Christy Moore. And that's, I guess, another tool to kind of hopefully bring people into this sense of that pub being a place where time doesn't really exist. It just stays in the same
nostalgic
place.
And Orla comes in
place
one of the days and she puts on a Sinead O'Connor CD.
Yeah.
And it's not mentioned in name, but I recognise one of my favourite songs of all time.
No way, Ray. Oh my God, you're going to play this?
Yeah, I'm going to play a bit of it.
Beautiful.
Any excuse.
Thank you.
So amazing that, isn't it?
Like, it's so
her
amazing.
Voice, just
the
bareness of it, the emotion, just everything. And then the diddly eye comes in at the end.
Exactly, the diddly eye.
Yeah.
And that's what, like, the book, I suppose, Orla, you know, as a young Irish woman, she's inspired by that because it feels Irish, this song, but it's also kind of outward looking. It's modern, it's contemporary.
Yes, yeah,
and
yeah.
All the owl fellas in the bar are like,
what is this? Do you follow the Eurovision at all?
I watched a bit of it with my mum. I was home last week when it was on.
Yeah.
But, oh my God, it's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like theatre.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Another thing just on music, you see HMV is returning to Ireland.
So the taxi driver told me that on the way here.
Yeah.
I couldn't
That's
believe
big news
that.
Too, isn't
so
it?
What are they going to sell? Vinyl, obviously. But are CDs still a thing?
I have it in my head if you want to know.
Go on.
5,000 albums, 5,500 CDs.
In what format? So albums?
No, album, vinyl albums.
Vinyl
5,000 vinyl albums, 5,500 CDs, 3,000 pop culture items. So I was asking them upstairs, what's that? They're saying Strange Things and stuff like that, mugs and...
Okay, t-shirts and
little,
caps.
Little
and
figurines, all that. No,
phone
t-shirts.
Holders.
1,000 t-shirts specified on the front of the Irish Times.
Oh.
So there you go. Now, here's a quick question because we'll come back to you in a minute. But Ellen, who does our social media, asked you this question earlier on.
Mm.
A song... that you wish you were hearing for the first time again.
Yeah. Okay, so the song I chose is by Daft Punk and it's quite obscure and I'm sorry about that. It's not that obscure. It's called Burning. And the reason why is because when I heard this song for the first time, I was on the dance floor of Shine Nightclub in Belfast, which is where I really discovered clubbing and club culture.
You were in university there.
In university in Queens, yeah. And I didn't know what the song was called. I just called it the Zip Song because there's a sound in the song that sounds like a zip going up and down all the way through.
Okay.
And the DJ used to play it every week. And then when I found... There it is.
Yeah.
I hear the zip.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I used to just love it so much. And it just brings me back to that feeling of, you know, being on a dance floor, making all these new friends, discovering this new music. And it just felt so exciting. I had bleach blonde, really crop hair, big nose ring.
I thought it was
a bee's knees. Big wide jeans, really, really wide jeans. I'm cringing now thinking about it, but it was fun times.
Yeah, burning Daft Punk.
Yeah.
So 44 and you're still DJing. It's sort of a sideline now.
I thought I'd give up when I was 40, but it's still happening. It's more than a sideline, actually. It's kind of become a big part of what I do, again, because of... I've rearranged how I do it a little bit, I suppose.
In what way? You sit down now, do you?
No, not quite. But I actually DJ for longer, but I had issues with club culture and the fact the clubs opened at a certain time and closed at a certain time. And me, as normally would be the headline DJ, would be playing 1 or 2 in the morning. And that was not amenable to my life and having young kids.
Two children, yeah.
So I made up a club night which started at 7 and ended at midnight. It's called Before Midnight. And since I've been doing it last year, it's just been so brilliant. And it sells out really quick. And right. We'll be doing it all over the UK and Ireland. Well, in Dublin and in Belfast. We need to do more in Ireland, but it's just been so brilliant.
Is it nostalgia?
No, it's me. It's me playing for 4 hours.
Yeah, but it is stuff like that from early noughties.
Yeah, I play that stuff, but I also play new stuff. So okay. It's kind of like it's really everything and anything. And I've never felt so free as a DJ, and I can kind of be really indulgent and play all sorts of stuff I've never really been able to play in the past because I've always had to play kind of a headline set. So this is nice. The crowd are older, but it's basically for anyone who needs sleep. People who've got a Saturday job, people who need to study. You get a lot of women there, a lot of parents with young kids. You get different generations. I had a grandmother, a mother and a daughter all right. coming to my Manchester show.
Three generations. Yeah, where would you get it?
Amazing. Honestly.
They have to do...
It felt like this rebirth.
Do you have to do Sweet Caroline then at the end?
No.
Hands, touch. You do, you
it's
do.
Not, it's not far off that though. What? I do, like the last half hour is full wedding. Like
is
we go,
go on,
full
give us a...
wedding. We play like the Communards.
Yes.
We play Sylvester.
Yeah, you make me feel.
We play Entrance, Set You Free, you know,
right,
that,
yeah,
like
yeah,
all
yeah.
that, all yeah, that yeah. ABBA, bit of ABBA.
Right.
It's not about being cool.
Right.
But it's just about what feels right in the night.
Brilliant.
And it's very fun.
So you've a podcast as well, Change, and when Emily rang you yesterday, Louis Theroux had just left your house. It is Theroux, not Theroux.
It's Theroux, yeah,
yeah
Theroux,
yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. Louis Theroux had just left the house, yeah, so I've got a little office in the garden, and he came over, and he's actually local to me, and yeah, we recorded an episode of Changes, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. He was a nice guy. It was kind of strange because he walked in and you know the way you see him on telly and he goes into people's houses and he starts picking things up. And I kind of cleaned the kitchen beforehand thinking, what's it, you know, seeing it through Louis Theroux's eyes. But he didn't do any of that. He
was tall man.
Very tall.
Yeah.
Very, very intelligent.
Yes.
And it was quite intimidating interviewing him at first, but then it was totally fine. He was very nice.
He doesn't just give you an answer. He thinks about it first, I would imagine.
Yeah. Very considered.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But also like, so, you know, he knows exactly what he's doing. You know, he's only going to give you what he wants to give you. You know, he's
you're not going to catch him out.
Not going to catch him. God, not a chance.
You're not going to get something he never said before.
Exactly.
Or some big revelation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a problem, isn't it, in the world we live in now?
Yeah.
Everyone's so guarded. There was all those brilliant moments, say, on the Late Late Show years ago. And even on radio and Parkinson even got some stuff, although it was pre-recorded. He would have got some brilliant stuff.
Yeah.
That just doesn't happen anymore.
I think there's such a consciousness, I suppose, of how things spread as well. You know, radio, since I've been doing it, and I used to come in my pyjamas.
Right.
Now there's cameras everywhere. There's social media. Like, it's not just about this conversation. This conversation will live in other formats, in other places.
Yes, yeah.
And I suppose people are conscious of that and of just how easy it is to make anything you say and take it out of context and make it clickbait.
Yeah, did you celebrate the coronation?
Sorry, I didn't, actually. Talking about clickbait. No, where was I at the coronation? I was in Washington, D.C. playing a wedding.
Right.
Weirdly, someone flew me over there to play a wedding.
I think you decided you'd be out of the country on the day, did you?
I saw the day. It was like, yes.
Yeah, I'll take that.
I'll take that, thank you.
$100, yeah, whatever, whatever.
Yeah.
I'll play Sweet Caroline if I have to. Yeah. So you were offered an MBE.
Oh, God.
Yes. Weren't you?
Yeah, I forgot I said this and now it's good. Now I'm going to be asked about it.
Yeah.
Yes, I was offered an MBE last summer. It was.
Right.
When I was in Ireland on my holidays, actually. I was in West Cork.
Which is a sort of an honour. We don't have an honours list in this country, which I think we should have.
Mm. I think you should too. I think it would be very lovely, actually.
Yes.
Especially when you take that context of the kind of hierarchical system that is awarding it. You know, it's kind of if it was an honour system that was voted by the people or, you know, but in a democratic way or something.
If it was transparent and uncorruptible,
it would be lovely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
so
wouldn't
it
though?
Just to recognise people who do some great work.
And there's lovely aspects of the honour system in the UK. You know, they honour, there's so many people who you won't have heard of that get honours, you know, people who do incredible work for charity and all of that. But yeah, I thought about it and...
So what happens? Do you get a phone call or a letter or
I got an email from the Foreign Commonwealth Affair. I can't remember what it's some big long fancy name.
And they say, hello, Annie.
I can't remember. remember. They just sent, it was quite a kind of well-worded email, and says, you know, this, we would, they would like to award you with this. Would you consider accepting it? So it wasn't like you've been awarded. I think they checked to see whether you would. And then you say, yes, I would accept this. Right. And then you get the official thingamy, Bob.
So how did the chats go? Did you say have a chat with your parents about it?
Yeah. I had a chat with my mom. I had a chat with my big brother. Had a chat with a couple of friends. Had a chat with Google. Had a look on there and just looked. Just, it's always good to kind of see what people have done in the past, you know. And mostly it was just my own instinct. I think you get to a certain point in life where you just have to trust yourself. Mm. And my instinct at the start was always to say no. But I just wanted to say, feel really good about saying no.
And you don't have to give it an excuse. You just say no.
Yeah, I just said no. Well, I did. I was very like, really, thanks. It was very nice of you to offer, but I can't do that while the language is what it is with regards to Empire. It doesn't sit comfortably with me. Yeah. And if you ever think about changing the system of your honours, come back. Yes. I'll be here.
Oh, did you say that?
Oh, yeah. I've no problem. I'm well up for getting an award, but it's just the system around it and behind it that I don't necessarily feel comfortable with.
Like watching the coronation, because it was on, I was just passing through the room. Like it does look a bit. It looks dafter now. You know, I mean,
it's so funny. It's so funny when you live in England and you have the Irish perspective of it, because it's just gas.
Yeah,
I love looking at Irish Twitter when stuff like that happens, because it really gives you good perspective on it. Because England goes mad for it. Even people you think are, really, you know.
Yeah, we're gonna adorn this thing with diamonds from, you know, the Commonwealth, whatever. You could say they were pillaged, maybe not. And we're going to put it on your head. Now, it's going to be very uncomfortable. It's going to weigh 2 kilograms.
We're going to wedge head.
You may not be able to stand up, but it's all good. You will be king. Long live the king.
It is mad seeing it. It's so archaic, the whole thing. It felt like a trip back in time.
A big fan of Annie. Used to listen to her shows on internet cafe, in an internet cafe in Cork in the mid-2000s.
Oh,
was so proud
you.
To hear an Irish voice on the BBC.
Aww.
But we have a great tradition, haven't we, of Irish voices.
Good old Terry. Graham, before he left.
Why do the Irish do so well over there? That is a good question, isn't it?
It's interesting, actually. Yeah. I don't know. I think my experience with the BBC is they like accents. There's quite a consciousness there that not everyone can have that received pronunciation. Hello. Look, you know, they need to represent an entire population. And I think that was a part of me maybe getting a show, was because I sounded different.
Yeah.
So I think that did help me, actually, having an Irish accent.
Were you a woman being a sort of a club DJ type person? That was still, you were still in the minority, weren't you?
Very much. Right. Yeah, very much.
The minority of one or maybe two.
I guess it's different in different genres. Like there's a lot more female DJs in techno in that genre. But it certainly in my world, there was a handful.
Yeah.
A handful. And with regards to kind of festival lineups and that kind of thing, be a handful of females who would be headlining or in those top tiers.
You see, that we are different, you know, men and women. Yeah, we are different. And you know, but it's like, but we're drawn towards technology. And I know that's a generalisation.
Yeah.
You know, but
careful, right? That is a generalisation. Huge.
No, but we, like, men are drawn, that's the sheds.
They're like fiddling with
exactly,
things.
Don't they? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, that's why... the way it happened with men and DJing, because it's the technology.
I don't think. See, this is something I've thought about so much, but I think that you cannot just put aside gender conditioning. You know, when girls and boys are small, boys are encouraged to build things and do trains, and girls are given dolls and, you know, to makeup.
No, there's a huge part of that.
Like if you're a girl and you had a dad who brought you into the garage as a young one and taught you how to change things, and of course you'd be technical.
No,
I think so much of it is kind of unconscious conditioning, I think. Yeah.
But our brains are built differently.
Oh God, Ray.
They are, Annie. Like, come on. Do you want to have a debate here now?
Yes, I'm mad for it.
I've two books at home.
Really?
Yeah. No, no.
So biologically.
Biologically, yes.
Men's brains are different than women's.
Say for example, the area that deals with empathy is bigger in the female brain than it is in the male brain.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So that's just what I can remember from the book.
And socializing, women seem to be better at, that's for sure.
Yeah, and young girls play differently.
Mm.
Disregarding, you know, whether it's with dolls or whatever.
I was up the tree.
Yeah, no, but there you go. So anyway,
I guess there's exceptions to every rule.
Yes, there are. She's the main reason I'm going to Forbidden Fruit this summer. Annie Mac.
Oh, brilliant.
There you go. Please ask Annie, would she let her children get into the media?
The media. I would. But I think what will happen with my kids is, you know, an Ab Fab Safi. I think my kids, they'll end up being accountants. They've got a dad who makes, you know, rap and reggae music.
His name's
Tom T, but his kind of production name is Toddler T.
Toddler T.
Toddler T. It's like a reggae thing.
So they have Annie Mac and Toddler T.
Yeah. Right, okay. Ludicrous.
As parents,
so they're obviously going to be accountants and disown us at the earliest opportunity.
But be very aware of their Irish roots.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's a must.
So you're launching the book tonight in Dublin.
Yes.
Great.
Yes. I'm over here. I'm going to have a little bit of a knees up and get some people out and have a few drinks. And yeah, I mean, the three chapters of the book are set in Dublin. It feels right to come here and do that. It means a lot to me as well to do that. So
because Orla returns home to visit her parents.
She goes home for Christmas.
There's a very interesting storyline there with the dad and the mum and all that sort of thing. Mike wants to know the name of the Sinead O'Connor song.
Something on your grave.
Stretched on your grave.
Stretched on your grave. That's
we'll play a bit more of that and say goodbye.
So beautiful.
Annie Mac, thank you so much.
Great, thank you. Thank you for reading the book.
No, I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
I was sort of grown up because I'm slightly older than you.
Yeah.
So I was all grown up at that stage.
Yeah.
So I wasn't doing the heady stuff, but I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.